Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. Research in recent years has indicated the elderly tend to live longer if their homes are near a park or another green space, that college students who see trees outside their dorm room windows may study and learn better, that children with ADHD may have fewer symptoms after spending time in nature, that public housing residents interact more if they live near trees, and conversely, people who live in urban settings without trees and grass may be more violent, more aggressive. Today on Focus, we examine what impact, if any, the environment around you may have on your health and well-being, and we'll explore whether there is a correlation between green spaces and health, productivity, and happiness, or if there are other factors and explanations that just make it seem that way. We have two guests with us. Both teach here at the University of Illinois and have collaborated in the past to study the relationship between people and their physical environment. Dr. William Sullivan is a professor of landscape architecture here at the U of I. Dr. Sullivan, welcome to Focus.
Nice to be with you, Craig.
And Dr. Ming Kuo is director of the Landscape and Human Health Laboratory and associate professor of natural resources and environmental sciences at the University of Illinois. Dr. Kuo, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
As we explore this potential connection between the environment and our quality of life, we welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome your questions on WILL's Facebook page, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is willpublicmedia. Let me start with you, Dr. Kuo. Back in 1993, you and Dr. Sullivan founded the Human Environment Research Laboratory to study the relationship between people and the physical environment. What was the impetus for setting this up?
That's that's what we do. Bill's background is in landscape architecture, but he focused on the sort of human side of that. And my background is in psychology, but I focused on the effects of the physical environment on people. So sort of that's what made sense.
So what did you want to learn? How did you even approach, okay, we've set this up, what are our ultimate goals here?
We're very much interested in measuring the impact of everyday contact with green spaces on people's capacity to function effectively, to meet their goals in their own lives, to live healthy lifestyles.
And I gave some examples right at the top there of some things that you have studied and that others have studied. So maybe we could talk a little bit about some of those studies. Let's start with the notion that children with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder may have fewer symptoms after spending time in sort of lush outdoor areas. And you've studied that in a couple of different studies in the
right.
First decade of the 2000s.
Right. I guess I'll pick two, maybe two and a half studies to
okay.
mention. One was we took a bunch of kids on forced marches through the Urbana, folks might be interested, Crystal Lake Park, downtown Urbana, and a residential area, which were sort of selected to be graded in how green they were. But they were all clean, reasonably attractive, safe, low pedestrian and low car traffic, similar weather. And so we took these kids on these walks. Or rather, we had someone who didn't know what the study was about take them on the walks. And then we had them come indoors afterwards and have somebody else who didn't know which walk they had been on test their attention.
Cool. Now, these are kids that had been diagnosed with ADHD, is that right?
Right. Right. So these are all kids who have been diagnosed, and furthermore, they are not on their meds at the time of the walk. So we test their concentration after the different walks. The walks are a week apart, and we rotate the order of the walk so that it's not always the park first or the park last. And then we compare it. How does Susie do after the park walk versus the other two walks? And sure enough, Susie concentrates much better after the park walk. And what was really exciting was the effect sizes in this study. That is the difference between their performance after the park versus the other two settings was as large as other estimates of the difference between attentionally normal kids and kids with ADHD. So it's also as large as the maximum effect of methylphenidate. So we don't know how long it lasts, of course, but the point is, at least for some period of time, we're really able to it looks like, more or less erase the ADHD deficit.
Now, there's been previous research that has noted connections between just good old plain exercise, getting out and walking around, period, and better attention for everyone, not
right.
just somebody suffering with ADHD.
Right. So this shows you that even though they're walking in each case, the green walk does them more good than the other walks.
Okay. And you said that was one study.
Yeah.
And you wanted to mention one and a half others.
Okay. So the other study I'd like to mention is a national study where we looked at, we asked parents who have kids diagnosed with ADHD to tell us about their kids' symptoms and when they had more or less. And what's interesting there is basically we find the same thing, that parents report, oh, yeah, my kid is in better shape after fishing or bike riding in a shady neighborhood or playing basketball outside rather than playing basketball inside, those kinds of comparisons. And not only is that true, it's true for different age kids, kids with hyperactivity or without, kids of different, and most importantly, different kids from different places. So this was true not only for folks in rural areas and suburban areas, as well as inner city, major city areas. So what's interesting is what the parents consider relatively green in those different contexts is probably very different, mm-hmm. right? So what an inner city mom is going to consider green is probably doesn't even count as green for somebody rural. And yet the relatively green is always the better context for kids.
And then the half study.
Oh, and then the half study is we've got some interesting hints that even kids who are indoors do better if they are in an indoor place where they can see a lot of greenery, so like a sunroom, versus indoors in like a basement or something where you don't see the outside and don't see greenery.
So that would suggest just even having a few plants around might potentially make a difference.
Yeah, the interior plant literature is pretty mixed.
Okay.
I think there are some findings, but there are a lot of non-findings as well.
Dr. Sullivan?
So I just wanted to pick up on something you said at the beginning, Craig. You said when you were referring to Ming's studies, you talked about kids being in lush green spaces. And I think one of the things that we're finding both in her work and in others' work is that it doesn't necessarily have to be lush. It can be a few trees and some grass, or a view of relatively, it can be a small space that's green. It doesn't have to be a lush, wonderful section of the arboretum or the botanical garden that you go to, or a really lovely wetland area in a forest preserve district. It can be a pocket park at the end of your block. It can be street trees. It can be a backyard space that's got some plants or a garden in it. So what we don't want to leave you with here is the impression that you need to have a wilderness-type experience, or you need to go right. far away from home. In fact, one of the things that I think we want to leave you with is that we need to find ways to enhance the number and amount of opportunities to get in touch with green spaces on a daily basis.
To that end, let's also talk for a couple of minutes, Dr. Sullivan, about today. I think that the two of you collaborated on dealing with the Robert Taylor Homes. Was this in Chicago back in 2001? Sort of refresh, tell us a little bit about what it was you were trying to find out.
So we've got, I guess that would be the aggression study, huh? So we have a number of studies that we published from our work over quite a number of years at Robert Taylor Homes. But in this study also had an important attentional component to it. We'd done work in Chicago over a number of years, and we noticed that people were more likely to be outdoors in greener areas than they were in more barren areas. And that led us to think about what might be some of the consequences of people spending more time in green spaces there.
Let me just jump in here. We were looking at courtyards. So architecturally identical courtyards that had a little bit of greenery, some tree cover, and some shade would have, when we walked by, we would see people using those spaces, whereas these sort of blasted out moonscapes that are also courtyards, same dimensions, same mm-hmm. surrounding buildings, but no shade or no grass or nothing, just sort of pavement, those would be more or less unused.
So one of the beautiful things about, Robert Taylor's been demolished, and that's probably a good thing. It was not a well-designed or good place to raise children, or to retire and grow old. But from a researcher's standpoint, it was really ideal in a number of ways. There were 28 architecturally identical buildings that varied only in their brick color. Some were blonde, and others were red brick. Mm-hmm. There was very little landscape treatments. There were two benches in the whole place. One was under a tree, and one was in the middle of a parking, or kind of at the edge of a parking lot. When it was built, it was a pretty green place, but due to lack of maintenance and lack of investment in the landscape over time, a lot of the turf grass got eroded and just died. And the people that lived there complained about all the dust and mud being tracked in. And in their wisdom, the Chicago Housing Authority decided to pave a huge number of these green spaces, or what had formerly been green spaces. So what happened by the time we started doing work there in the 90s was that you had architecturally identical places with people randomly assigned to those apartments, but varied a little bit in terms of the contact with green spaces. Around some of those buildings, there were little pockets of trees, maybe 6-8 trees. And around other buildings, there were, just a moonscape. I mean, just parking lots and paving for acres and acres and acres. So it constituted a naturally occurring experiment to look at the impact of contact with green spaces on people in their day-to-day lives. You want to say a little something about the study? I just want to.
So what we were interested in looking at was there was this idea that had been already established that nature has an effect on how well we concentrate and how well we function cognitively. And I was interested in pursuing the possibility that your cognitive capacity actually has effect on your social functioning. So, for instance, if you can focus on, if you can think well in a difficult situation or inhibit the impulse to say something unfortunate, then that interaction is probably going to go better and not escalate. And this was actually not something I came up with, but Steve Kaplan suggested, I think, sort of off the cuff. But so we wanted to look at that. Does the effect of nature on concentration still hold when we look at these apartment buildings where really the green condition is so minimal? It's the opposite of lush. So does even a tiny bit of nature have an impact? And then if it does have an impact on people's cognitive functioning, does that extend to their social functioning? Because obviously levels of aggression and violence are a big concern in inner city settings.
So were you able to come to some conclusion based off of those studies?
Let's talk a little bit about this concept of mental fatigue, because I think it's central to some of the findings that we'll talk about today. So all of us that are listening to this radio program right now have experienced what can be called mental fatigue, this sense that you've focused your attention hard for a period of time. We've all experienced it at the end of a big effort, writing a proposal, reviewing efforts, creating an extensive budget.
Preparing for a talk show, say.
Yeah, right.
And doing your taxes.
Yeah, doing your taxes, right. So at the end of that period, or, on a daily basis, after I've gotten through my 100-something emails, I'm just like, I can't even look at another email. I can do lots of other things, but this, I'm just fatigued.
Yeah.
As humans, we experience that on a daily basis. And that capacity to pay attention, it fatigues, and it's restored if you go, a good night's sleep, and you're up and at it the next day, and you can do pretty well. The problem with many of us and the way we've constructed our society today is that most of us get mentally fatigued before it's time to go to sleep.
Right.
And it turns out that having a view of a green space gives us a little opportunity to restore our capacity to pay attention or to focus, and it reduces the amount of mental fatigue we're experiencing in the moment. Now, the problem with mental fatigue, not only is it that it's hard to concentrate, but there's a bunch of other things that are likely to come along with it. When you're mentally fatigued, you're a little more likely to be irritable.
No, I'm not.
You're a little more likely to be impulsive.
Yeah.
You're a little more likely to jump to some opportunity that seems attractive in the moment, even though it may conflict with your long-term goals. You're a little bit more likely to miss a subtle social cue that someone has offered, and you don't pick up on it. And as a consequence, perhaps that may escalate into a violent situation.
So that's what you were trying to reach for in mm-hmm. these studies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And again, were you then able to conclude something decisive?
You want to know our findings, don't you?
Yes, I do. You picked up on that social cue. Well done, sir.
I think so. We looked at residents' self-reports. So we interviewers asked residents to tell them how they had been handling conflicts recently. And they gave them plenty of opportunity to say, you know, to brag about the things they had done well. And they also asked them, okay, have things occasionally not gone so well, and tell me about those. And so it turns out that for when we look at aggression against another adult, we get very consistent findings. So residents who have who are reporting about their interactions with a partner or a significant adult report more verbal aggression, more aggression overall, more mild violence, and more severe violence, which includes things like threatening to use a knife or gun or use a knife or gun. So that really means severe violence.
Right.
And we see really consistent patterns all across all of those measures. The picture's slightly muddier for kids. So when you discipline children in that context, there are some tactics that are really common and that don't differ across greener buildings versus less green buildings.
But the end result is that at least when it came to the study and the Robert Taylor homes, you found that people that had that access to green space were a little less aggressive.
Right.
Those that didn't were a little bit more aggressive.
Yeah, I really like how you put that, Craig, because what we're not saying is that if you're exposed to green spaces, you're never going to engage in violence. You're never going to be verbally aggressive or physically aggressive. What we're saying is that the probability that you will be aggressive is reduced by having contact with green spaces. And it looks like, well, we have evidence from this work that the mechanism or the explanatory pathway is that people are a little less mentally fatigued in those green spaces.
Mental fatigue aside, could it be that we just happen to seek out places to live and work that reflect the personalities we already have so that peaceful, maybe socially engaged people seek out trees while more aggressive, intense people prefer to live in the city or in a setting without it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I guess I would say in the Robert Taylor Homes findings that we just discussed, that's a case where residents they don't really have any choice which apartment they end up in. And so they're not really seeking, they're just landing.
Well,
not seeking green places.
That also raises an economic factor I want to get to in just a minute. But first, a reminder, this is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guests are Dr. William Sullivan, professor of landscape architecture, and Dr. Ming Kuo, director of the Landscape and Human Health Laboratory and associate professor of natural resources and environmental sciences at the University of Illinois. We're discussing connections between the environment and our quality of life, and we welcome your questions and comments this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email your question or comment to will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again is 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. Can some of this be explained through economics and the economic conditions that some folks are in?
If you don't mind, I'd like to just go back to the previous question.
Okay.
About different folks choosing different settings to be in. I just want to, there's this great study from the University of Rochester that I wanted to share. It has to do with taking undergrads and randomly assigning them to be in a room either with or without a lot of plants or a slideshow of nature. and then asking them about their core values. You know, how important is it to you to become rich? How important is it to you to become successful in your career? How important is it to you to develop deep relations with others or to contribute something to society? And it turns out that after being in the room with the plants or the slideshow of nature, as opposed to the urban slideshow, these kids consistently report being more pro-social in their deepest aspirations. And what's really cool is when they run this with a little collection bucket for some random charity in the room, and they ask them, they ask them all these questions, and then they pay them for their time, and then they just, the experimenters leave, and then they see how much money is left in the little collection bucket after kids who've been exposed to nature versus not are leaving. So what happens is you see more money in that collection bucket after they've been sort of awash in images of nature.
I can see fundraisers listening everywhere saying, we got to get more trees in the room.
But it's just a delightful little study.
So which comes first, the attitude or the trees? Is it that nature is impacting the personality and attitudes of the folks, or is it that the attitudes?
Well, I think it has to be in this case, because you're randomly assigning the students to one condition or the other, and then that's changing them. Unless you think that it's just sheer luck that the more pro-social folks ended up in the plant condition. But that's what we do statistics for.
Right.
We run 60, 70 kids. We make sure it can't be just sheer chance.
That is really interesting. So let's get back to the economic question. The more money you have, the more choosy you can be about where you live and the environment in which you live. Since most of us would, I imagine, simply prefer to live somewhere where there are some trees and ponds around, what you're studying could be a contrast of rich and poor, and the more money you have, maybe the less you have to worry about money, and so you're less inclined to be violent and aggressive, you know, getting back to the Robert Taylor Holmes study, because you have less to be violent and aggressive about. Mm-hmm. Or is that just a grand oversimplification?
Well, I think there certainly are differences in who chooses to be where or live where. And if you have the means, you're more likely to seek out what we currently view as amenities, such as greenness. But I think what we're going to find is that greenness is something that we both like and appreciate, and that's good for us. One of those rare confluences of something that we want and is good for us.
So it's interesting to note that in some of the longevity research that's looked at and controlled for income, that you find income effects. So, for instance, in a study that was published in The Lancet in 2008 that looked at the entire population of Great Britain over a five-year period, 40 million people, and 366,000 of those people died during the study period. And the researchers looked at the cause of death, and they geocoded their address, and they measured the density of the green space right immediately around their residence, and then they had income information about each person as well, and they classified the individuals into three categories: high income, middle income, and low income. And what they found was that for the high income people, there was no relationship between the density of green space immediately around their home and the probability that they might die in the five-year period. But when they looked at the middle income and the low income folks, they found statistically strong correlations. That is to say that for the middle and low income people, the greener the landscape, the less likely they were to die over that five-year period. Now you might ask, okay, why is it not happening for the folks in the high? Why do we see no relationship for the folks in the highest income, and the strongest relationships with the folks in the lowest income category? Well, my guess is that people who have more money and more resources have, even if they live in a less green space, they can go to the country club, they can go to the beach, they travel on vacations. Maybe they have a second home that's in a green spot. So my guess is that measure of green space around a high-income person's home is not really a good measure of the amount of green spaces they get connected to on a daily basis. But on the other hand, maybe the measure of green space around a low-income person's home is a better measure of the amount of green spaces that they're actually connected to.
Dr. Kuo, I have your report here, Parks and Other Green Environments, Essential Components of a Healthy Human Habitat. And I'm looking at the executive summary, and there's a quote in here that I just wanted to note. And it's, you point out that maybe we sometimes get the question wrong a little bit, that the question is not, do people living in greener neighborhoods have better health incomes or outcomes, rather? It's, do people living in greener neighborhoods have better health outcomes when we take income and other advantages associated with greener neighborhoods into account?
Right. So like Bill says, there are a number, many, many studies where they control for SES, socioeconomic status, and they show that even when you take into account how wealthy the person is, still the greenness of their surroundings predicts better outcomes. And I think one thing to mention, I'm not sure if it's that study or another one also by the same folks in the UK, they find that the mortality associated with poverty is cut in half when you take greenness into account.
Right, that's the same one, yeah.
So that's kind of a nice, kind of a big finding. And then there's similar work with actual physician diagnoses of disease. So when you take, again, I think this is 345,000 folks in the Netherlands, when you take into account their socioeconomic status and you use the amount of greenness 1 or 3 kilometers around their house, around their postal code, it turns out you can predict their disease incidences in physician diagnoses for, I think, 15 or so out of 24 categories of disease. So a category would be cardiovascular disease. So in all cases, disease is more when you have less green. There's no case in which the disease actually occurs more if you have more green.
You know, Craig, these findings raise a fundamental question that's different from just, you know, how do we design places? And they raise questions about equity and justice within our communities. When you've got wealthy people that that have a relatively low chance of dying, no matter where they live, and poor people who have a considerably higher chance of dying in a 5-year period when they live in less green spaces or more barren spaces. And you see that probability of dying is reduced dramatically when poor people live in greener spaces. Then you realize that the context of our living environment and access to green spaces is more than just an amenity. It has real implications for health and well-being. And beyond that, it has real implications for questions about equity and justice within our society.
And those are questions I think we should continue to discuss in the second half of the show, but we are due to take a short break. So, again, a reminder, we're talking with Dr. William Sullivan, professor of landscape architecture, and Dr. Bing Kuo, associate professor of natural resources and environmental sciences, both at the University of Illinois. And we're talking about connections between the environment and our quality of life. We welcome you to the conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. It's time for a short break. This is Focus.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly, host of Live and Local on FM 90.9. Dancer, choreographer, calligrapher, and philosopher Tsung Liang Al Huang has felt a special affinity with the music of Bach for much of his life. That connection will be on visual and aural display at the Krannert Center in Urbana Thursday night in a concert called The Tao of Bach, a musical Tai Chi offering. On the Wednesday edition of the show, I'll talk with Al Huang and two of the musicians who will join him for that concert. It's Live and Local, weekdays at 4 p.m. on FM 90.9.
WILL programs are made possible with support from The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377, open 7 days a week for lunch and dinner.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing possible connections between the environment and our quality of life on today's program with Dr. Ming Kuo, Associate Professor of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences at the University of Illinois, and Dr. William Sullivan, a Professor of Landscape Architecture at the U of I. We welcome you to the conversation this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Just before a break, Dr. Sullivan, you were talking about some of the socioeconomic impacts of what we're talking about here, some of the implications of it, what it means in terms of social justice. The fact remains that we have people who, for one reason or another, might feel stuck in a certain community that doesn't have a lot of trees or grass or what have you. And then we have others in our culture who have the wherewithal to move to wherever they wish. And as such, we have seen over the course of, 50, 60 years, a move away from urban city kind of living to suburban living to what we've characterized in the last 10 or 20 years as sprawl, moving out more and more out towards nature to raise families near it. And that has raised a number of questions for folks about whether or not we're doing a service to ourselves and to our communities by spreading out away from one another. We're closer to trees, but we also knock down more trees to get closer to trees. And then we have further to go to get back to one another. So how do we jibe these two sort of seemingly conflicting issues?
Well, I don't know that they conflict. I would not. Let's not get caught in that dilemma.
Yeah. That's a great question, because a lot of folks, when I talk about the effects of greenness on people, will say, does that mean that what's good for people is sprawl? And actually, that's not at all the case. So like I said, we have evidence about the importance of window views of greenness. What's important is that your immediate surroundings do incorporate green element, trees and grass or flowers. It's not important that the space be expansive.
It may not be, though, that your research has indicated that sprawl is good, but it may be that that's what has motivated people to spread out, I guess, is that's the question I'm asking, and how that relates to what you were talking about, Dr. Sullivan, in terms of social justice, in terms of people being in sort of divided in life experiences, that some can choose to venture out. And as a result, they build really large houses that are on really large estates, and they're out way off in the edges of the suburbs. And then there are others who are kind of no, they're always going to be in, deep within a city. That's where they live. You know what I mean?
I do what you mean, but my guess is that the motivation for sprawl has had a huge amount to do with questions about race and class in our society, and people with the wherewithal to move away from poor people or people of color taking that option, seeking that option. And my guess is that that's a much more motivating factor in terms of suburban sprawl and sprawling neighborhoods than it is a desire to get close to nature. That's just my guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they wouldn't be buying those huge houses that have postage size stamped lots,
right?
and that have no trees whatsoever anywhere nearby.
So then what should we take away from this when it comes to the design of new homes, when it comes to the revitalization of cities, efforts to try and remake or re-envision neighborhoods we already have in existence?
Yeah, that's a great question. And Ming can talk about the Sustainable Sites Initiative that she's worked on for that. But I guess one thing I would say is that we want to, for a whole variety of reasons, not the least of which is the work that we've done individually or collectively and with our colleagues that shows that having connections to green spaces is healthy for people in their day-to-day lives. We want to create more dense living environments because it's just such a good idea from an environmental sustainability standpoint. And it's also a good idea in terms of getting people out of their automobiles and encouraging them to walk or bike to have active daily lives. So you want more dense settings for a whole variety of reasons, a number of which relate to health, some of which relate to sustainability. And then you just have to be smart about how you create those places so you make sure that you've got a lot of views to green space, a lot of connections to trees and grass and other natural elements. Water would be wonderful as well.
I guess I would say that my design recommendations would be to infuse the urban fabric with as much greenery as possible, if that means at every scale. So that means vest pocket parks. It means street trees. It means that if you're going to design a building for a site, you make sure that the windows face onto the green views. If you have a chair in a room, then maybe, and you have a green view, maybe your desk should face the window. So at every scale, I would look for ways to give people more contact, more especially visual, but also real outdoor contact with green.
You know, on our campus, one of the most beautiful spaces we have on our campus surrounds the Beckman Institute, which is a gorgeous building, and the landscape is stunning around it. And they made a decision to put the window, to move the hallway adjacent to the windows. So when you look into the building, when you're outside and you look in, what you see is through those windows is the hallway, and then the offices and laboratories are on the inside from there. And I've always thought, I understood the motivation. The motivation is to pull people out of their offices and get them in the hallways collaborating and talking. But my guess is that the vast majority of the time people spend in those buildings is actually in their offices.
Yeah.
And really, that's, if you want them sharp and you want to reduce their chances of being mentally fatigued, you put a big window in their office or in their laboratory that looks out onto a green space. You don't allocate the hallway to that.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guests are Dr. William Sullivan, a professor of landscape architecture, and Dr. Ming Kuo, director of the Landscape and Human Health Laboratory and associate professor of natural resources and environmental sciences at the University of Illinois. We're discussing connections between the environment and our quality of life, and we welcome your questions and comments this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. And let's take a call from Deborah in Urbana. Good morning, Deborah. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My first comment concerns Urbana, which has really gone, and Champaign. They have little corner parks. They take great care to take median strips between lanes of streets and turn them into little gardens. Urbana has an ordinance where you have to file a garden plan, but you don't have to have grass in your yard. You can have all plants and ground cover. And as a result, there's a great emphasis and priority and value placed on green space within the city, which I think makes for a better quality of life here. And I would like your comments on that versus a much older city, Paris, France, mm-hmm. where in the city proper, there is great emphasis on parks and green spaces and, you know, plantings, whether they're even in the ground or even in urns and things like that, versus the outskirts of Paris where the immigrants and much poorer people live. When you go there, there's hardly any green space, and it's very paved. And, of course, the violence that periodically has erupts in the outskirts. Now, part of it is certainly different socioeconomic circumstances, but one wonders if the lack of green space has something to do with part of the as you said, the mental fatigue that facilitates violence.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, Deborah. Interesting question, and I wanted to hear what you have to say about it.
I guess. I would say that the city of Urbana is right. That's right. It's kind of a model in terms of taking green seriously, and that the payoff is not just quality of life, but the research is showing a healthier, smarter, kinder, gentler population as well. And so on the flip side, the cost of leaving the outskirts of Paris barren may be more than it's not just that it looks ugly and boring. It's that it actually is it's not a healthy environment for people to live in. And therefore, as a result, people are more likely to behave in ways that are unhealthy and definitely suboptimal.
Dr. Sullivan?
Well, you know, the cost of living in a space, in an urban space that's barren, I think are pretty significant and shouldn't be underrated. Ming talked about her work with Andrea Faber-Taylor on children with attention deficit disorder, but that work has been, the findings there are similar to findings that have been done on typically functioning adults. There was a study at the University of Michigan in 2008 that used a similar methodology to what Ming and her collaborators used, where they asked people to walk in downtown Ann Arbor and in the University of Michigan Arboretum. And similar study design. What they found was that the Arboretum walk was associated with a 20% increase in capacity to pay attention. 20% increase. Now, we know from other work that when people are mentally fatigued, they're more irritable, they're more likely to be aggressive. And so when you say you're living in a barren place and you're not doing as well, part of it might be the context of the place. Part of it might be you as an individual and what you bring as an individual, but we can't really separate out the space anymore because we know the space or the place has such profound and measurable and consistent impacts on people.
I feel like I can't roll my eyes anymore at as I drive around Champaign-Urbana, all of the different places that are identified as park space. I used to do that. Years ago when I first moved here, I'd drive around and think, boy, every patch of grass they call a park here. But maybe there's a point to that. Maybe there's a purpose to that.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, Ming said a minute ago that her recommendation would be to infuse the urban area with as much green space as possible. And I like to think that we ought to be working towards having contact with nature at every doorstep so that people can just be, you know, take that first step out of their door, out of their house and be in a green space or look out the windows from their home or apartment building and
be. Or their workplace or schools.
Right. And be connected to green spaces.
Let's take another call. This is from Paul in Champaign County. Paul, welcome to the show.
Yeah, since you brought up the Beckman architecture, I've always been struck by the fact that there's only a utility door facing north. It seems kind of insular and maybe some other stronger words. But I wanted to go further about Urbana, and maybe it generally brings up the funding problem for this. I mean, when are we going to actually emphasize this? The Urbana has this Crystal Lake Park to downtown green pathway kind of envisioned, which would include a outside amphitheater near the station theater, and it's very visionary, but it's sort of been stymied by funding, and I was struck by funds being fungible that one of the things that's been blocking spending in Urbana is, maybe this has been corrected by now, but was the hospitals claiming their nonprofit status, and I think that money is tax money is still in abeyance or in escrow or whatever they would do to that. So, I mean, that's a digression, but just generally the money for this, even in a rather wealthy, generally community like Urbana, this really beautiful plan can't seem to go ahead. And there's a way of doing it in segments, but when it's finished, there'll be a downtown greenway, a pathway, bikeway, all the way up to Crystal Lake Park, and it's a very I think it implements what you were speaking of. So I'll put a sock in it and hang up and listen.
All right, thanks very much, Paul, for the call. Well, you know, this does raise the question of how much is research like this taken into account when it comes to really long term visions and planning for reshaping communities.
Well, it's already having an impact. So the the U.S. Congress, what is it? The U.S. Conference of Mayors.
Conference of Mayors, yeah.
Has a resolution in support of urban forestry for many of these reasons. The Hope Six money, a lot of it was previously intended entirely for sort of bricks and mortar renovations, and then I'm told that after these findings came out, they really diverted a significant amount of it to changing the outdoor spaces in public housing.
Hope Six is the money that came through the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development that is responsible for tearing down a lot of these high-rise buildings and building a smaller scale, much more sensitively designed communities that have a decent amount of green space associated with them.
So people have been taking these findings and going with them, although I think you're right that it hasn't become widespread yet.
We have an email from John. He asks if you would address the use of functional landscaping, such as personal and community gardens, rather than simply decorative landscaping. He says growing food would seem to address some of the socioeconomic issues that you're talking about.
Right on, John. That's exactly right. And, you know, some of the best practices in terms of urban design and landscape architecture these days are moving towards more functional landscapes. And my guess is that those, especially landscapes that allow people to engage with them, so gardening, for instance, probably produces really significant benefits. We know from studies of community gardens that they produce a whole lot more than tomatoes. They produce stronger ties between people in the neighborhood and more resilient communities. So I think more functional landscapes, so community gardens would be one thing, but we have to really rethink the way we're treating water in urban areas as well. And we've got significant flooding problems, and when it rains, we call it a storm, and we try and get rid of storm water as quickly as possible. We should start thinking about rainwater, and when we think about rainwater, I think we think about a real resource, something that could be conserved and integrated into the landscape. My colleague Gail Fulton is part of a project in Champaign that's doing some really innovative work with rainwater and redoing the streets and in an effort to try and keep the rainwater from getting in the storm sewers immediately, but allowing it to go into the parkway and then creating parkway plantings that are, instead of just turf grass, have a rich variety of herbaceous and woody plants that can withstand dry and wet conditions. I think those kinds of things, where we think about a landscape that functions from a more sustainable standpoint, will also have very measurable and positive impacts on health and well-being of the community members.
That's right. So the design principle there is kill as many birds or or do something nice to as many birds with one stone as you can. So we're going to get vegetables as well as human health, as well as human optimal functioning, as well as rainwater management, all out of the same land.
Are you in the process of developing a new studies related to the environment and human health and well-being?
Yes, I'm replicating or attempting to replicate some of the work in the Netherlands that I mentioned. So the 340,000 folks, physician diagnoses of disease. We're going to try to do something like that. We're doing in my lab a bunch of work on ADHD and kids' academic performance in schools. So pretty busy.
We've got a couple things going. One is the we just finished collecting data from 320 folks in Champaign-Urbana this summer, and we looked at we were kind of mean to them. We gave them a stressful experience. We asked them to come into the lab, get calmed down, and we took cortisol measures from them, and we got physiological measures of their current state of being. Then we asked them to make a short, impromptu 5-minute speech. And then we did something that was really terrible. We asked them to subtract 16 from a series of 4-digit numbers. Mm. So we'd say, well, please subtract 16 from 1,912.
Oof.
We did that for 5 full minutes.
In their heads, right?
Yeah.
In their heads, right. In their heads, and they had to say their answer out loud, and then we gave them immediate feedback.
Yeah.
If they got the answer right, then we'd give them a next number. And if they got it wrong, we'd say, wrong, and we'd ask them to do it again. It's, I did it. And I looked at my data afterwards. This is a very reliably stressful experience.
119 and a half. Oh, yeah. That's my guess. I'm not sure if I got that right.
Anyway, afterwards we showed them these three-dimensional videos that we'd created of street landscapes that varied in terms of green spaces. And Frances had a half study that she talked about. This is a half study. Yesterday we looked at the cortisol results, and they look very promising. That people that watch the greener videos have faster recovery from the stressful experience than people that looked at the more barren videos. Mm. So. And then I've got some work going on at the prison in Danville, the State of Illinois Prison Penitentiary in Danville. We've got a productive prison landscape program going there in which we're trying to engage men who are incarcerated at the prison with gardening activities and composting activities and actually engaging with the landscape. And we're looking at the impacts and benefits on them.
We're going to have to leave it there. I'm sorry, we are just out of time, but I do want to say thank you to both of you. Dr. William Sullivan is professor of landscape architecture here at the U of I. Dr. Sullivan, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Craig.
And Dr. Ming Kuo is director of the Landscape and Human Health Laboratory and associate professor of natural resources and environmental sciences at the U of I. Dr. Kuo, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. You can go to it directly at will.illinois.edu/focus. You'll find some links there to topics related to today's program. You now have a second chance to hear this program each weeknight at 8 on WILL AM 580. So if you know someone who might enjoy hearing it but is unable to listen weekday mornings at 10, let them know about our nightly rebroadcasts at 8 p.m. On tomorrow's show, in the coming weeks, Focus will provide you with an opportunity to speak directly with candidates in the 13th Congressional District race and the 52nd State Senate District race. We'll begin with the Republican running for the Illinois Senate from the 52nd District, John Babinek. That's on tomorrow's program.